Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, do animals get depression, alcoholism, eating disorders? We'll explore the surprising common ground between animals and us and what we can learn from animals about healing. Then on the Scholar Circle, as violent conflict and human rights abuses continue throughout so many parts of the world, we'll explore the politics and ethics of humanitarian intervention. Barbara Natterson Horowitz is with us. She is a cardiology professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and serves on the medical advisory board of the Los Angeles Zoo. Catherine Bowers is also with us. She was a staff editor at The Atlantic and a writer and producer at CNN International. Together, they co-authored the book Zoobiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. Welcome to the two of you. So great to have you with us. Barbara Natterson Horowitz, let's start with you. You opened this book with this vignette about where you had this aha moment. You're a cardiologist, but you were actually working with a monkey. What happened?
Right. Well, when this happened, I'd been happily practicing cardiology at UCLA Medical Center, you know, on human patients with heart attacks and high cholesterol. And then I had this opportunity to join the medical advisory board of our local zoo. And, you know, of course, zoos around the country are staffed by highly qualified veterinarians who take excellent care of their patients. But from time to time, the vets will sometimes reach into the human medical community just for assistance with, you know, something. And I happen to be an expert in cardiac imaging. So I had this opportunity to occasionally leave my human patients and go to the zoo and hang out with the veterinarians. And it was there, a couple of things happened. The first was I heard the vets on rounds talking about congestive heart failure in a gorilla or breast cancer in a tiger or, you know, compulsive disorders in a polar bear. And it was the first time that I had really thought that the same diseases that I was taking care of my human patients, veterinarians take care of in all kinds of animal patients. So that was one of the early aha moments. But then there was this one particular patient that I became involved with. It was a tamarin monkey. Tamarin monkeys are these adorable little Central and South American monkeys. They live at the top of the canopy of the rainforest. And on this day, they wanted a cardiac ultrasound done on this tamarin. And while I was there, they were giving the monkey some sedative to make her sleepy. I approached her very closely, and I looked deep into her eyes, and I said, "Oh, you're so, you know, cute little Spitzbuben." And I was trying to reassure her, to comfort her, like I would do with a human patient. But the vet put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Please back away. You're scaring her, actually. You're going to give her capture myopathy." And I'd never heard of capture myopathy. Myopathy is a medical term. It means disease of the muscle. But, you know, capture myopathy, I've never heard of. So I went home and I Googled it, and I learned that there's this syndrome that vets have been describing and treating and preventing for decades, involving animals who are really, really scared or who are, you know, who are being chased or restrained, that their bodies can become flooded with adrenaline, which can poison the muscles of their body, including their heart muscles sometimes, and on occasion they can actually die. And this was particularly interesting because there was a recently characterized human condition, something called stress cardiomyopathy or, you know, the broken heart syndrome, in which human physicians had described patients who had experienced traumatic events, seeing a loved one die or losing their life savings with the roll of a dice, being left at the altar, really awful experiences, they too could be flooded with adrenaline and sometimes have an acute heart failure and die. And so as I was reading about capture myopathy, particularly reading reports of it going back decades, and then thinking about this human syndrome, which had only recently been characterized, I just realized that, you know, there was this gulf between veterinary and human medicine, and that vets knew all kinds of things that we physicians might not know, and this is an opportunity to really create some bridges.
You said that vets knew all this material that doctors for humans don't know. Is the reverse also true?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely. Physicians specialize in one species, so we typically, not only are we quite expert on Homo sapiens, in human medicine there's a tremendous amount of subspecialization. So in my case, for example, yes, I'm an internal medicine doctor, but then I specialized in cardiology, and then within cardiology I do imaging, and then within imaging I do a specific kind of imaging. So we get narrower and narrower. So yes, there are going to be pieces of things that we physicians know that vets don't know. But very traditionally, there's been passage of information from the human side to the veterinary side. What has been missing is us physicians and nurses and folks on the human side really looking at all of this knowledge in the veterinary literature that has been overlooked on the human side. So the arrow has pointed from the human to the animal, but not so much from the animal to the human.
The most surprising elements of your book, Zubiquity, for me, were some of the behavioral or psychological, psychophysical disorders that animals also get. It was quite fascinating, for example, to find out about animals and addiction, and that animals get addicted just as humans do to particular substances. I remember reading about the dog that was licking the toad. Catherine Bowers.
This was something I was also surprised by. I approached this topic as a journalist and a writer, and I was surprised at how little I myself knew about the overlaps between animal medicine and human medicine. In terms of addiction, of course, most animals are not going to patronize their local corner liquor store or their corner drug dealer or their pharmacist, but those active ingredients in all of those intoxicants are found in nature, in fermented berries and natural, let's say, opiates in something like a poppy, and animals will eat those and get high. We found examples of bighorn sheep who scale cliffs in order to get their dose of a hallucinogenic lichen, and sometimes they grind their teeth down to the gums trying to get their fix of it. We talked to veterinarians who are sometimes called to the scene where massive flocks of birds have died en masse after consuming fermented berries and then essentially flying while intoxicated. And sadly, they often fly into buildings and die of the same kinds of things that human drunk drivers die of, broken and internal bleeding and things like that.
And then there was the animal that would go into the poppy farms.
Yes, that was in Tasmania. Tasmania is where they grow most of the world's opium that's meant for medical use. And they have these big fields of poppies and fences around them, but that doesn't keep a certain individual from sometimes jumping into the fence and eating the poppy straw and sap. And then those individuals sometimes get high and thrash around and have to be removed the next morning. And those are actually wallabies.
So what does this tell us about human addiction when we look at the animal kingdom? As you pointed out in your book, Zubiquity, it's not that every animal becomes an addict. It's only some animals that become addicted. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz, how can we use this to understand our own addictions?
There's the medical piece and then the more sort of psychosocial piece in terms of how it can help us. Medically, you know, one of the most interesting things we learned is that not all animals, even within a group, are going to be equally interested in partaking, that there are going to be differences. And why that is probably the answer in animals is the same as it is in humans. It's a combination of genetics and probably life experiences. I mean, we now know that the experiences, you know, of early childhood and even sometimes gestation can affect which of our genes are turned on and not turned on, and that, in fact, can then affect our behavior and our responsiveness to drugs. So that variation within a group of animals in terms of interest in and then continued use, I think, is interesting. And the other piece which that connects to is just addiction. It continues to be, unfortunately, such a stigmatized medical problem, and people who suffer with this issue not only deal with an extremely challenging, you know, biophysical problem, they also deal with stigma, shame, a lot of misunderstanding and blame. And, you know, we think that for some patients, just knowing that addiction is not uniquely human, in fact, it is species-spanning. There are examples from it in the wild that naturalists have been writing about for decades. That knowledge itself can help some suffering patients.
There were others that were also what we would think would be human behaviors uniquely, but you point out that these are found in the animal kingdom, some obsessive compulsive behaviors, this sort of seemingly self-destructive behavior, like the horse biting itself over and over again till it bleeds. Catherine Bowers.
Yeah, I was really interested in these overlapping behaviors that I had always thought of as being uniquely human, as being some sort of combination of our big human brains that were somehow massively different from other animals and our culture. Now, of course, a lot of what we do as humans is a result of a combination of our culture and our specific evolution that makes us human and not something else. But the idea that there's underlying behaviors that might drive a lot of similar behaviors, I think, is really worth looking at. We looked at the question of self-harm and self-injury, and that seems to me to be something that only a person would think about doing. You know, you hear about cutters sometimes. Psychiatrists call people who self-harm cutters.
There were some famous ones.
In our research, we found out that Princess Diana was somebody who talked publicly about her cutting. Angelina Jolie, Johnny Depp and Colin Farrell are all others who have talked about this in either sort of video forums or in magazine articles. And it's something that when you talk to sufferers about it, they say that cutting gives them relief. And this was something that really surprised Barbara and me. How could something that causes your body harm actually give you relief? And so by asking, do animals ever self-injure, that allowed us to take it out of the realm of culture and human behavior and just see if there's something about the act of cutting that can help all patients.
And what did you find?
Well, what we realized was that an animal is not going to take a tool and carve into its skin, but they have another arsenal of sharp objects that they can sometimes put on themselves, and that includes talons and claws and their own teeth. We learned that, as you said, horses who are isolated in stalls will sometimes start a behavior called flank biting. It's where they bite at their own sides, and they bite and they bite and they bite until they draw blood and sometimes continue to bite. And what veterinarians have noticed is that if they return that animal to its herd, which is the natural social grouping that it evolved to be a part of, sometimes those behaviors will stop. And if it's not possible to return the animal to its herd, sometimes they just give it a companion, sometimes a little chicken or a goat, and the presence of another animal with it in the stall will help it stop those behaviors. We think that that's found in our research is that when veterinarians return a self-injuring horse to its herd or provide it with a companion, sometimes those behaviors will stop.
What does that tell us?
Well, I think it speaks to potentially why human patients self-injure. I mean, this is one of these challenges clinically that is kind of like so shocking. Hearing patients describe the act of cutting oneself as being a source of relief and release, it feels very counterintuitive. But when you talk to veterinarians about how they understand why and how self-injury occurs, it begins to take a different shape. I mean, a lot of animals, from reptiles and fish to birds and mammals, use grooming to self-soothe. We do it ourselves. You know, a lot of us when do little tiny grooming, micro-grooming, let's call it, activities to sort of calm ourselves throughout the day, either stroking our hair or, you know, picking at our cuticles or whatever it is. And animals, you see, even our cats and dogs in our homes, will begin to lick themselves and groom as a stress response. It does calm an animal to groom oneself. So some of these self-injurious behaviors that animals engage in center around grooming activities, but they are actually amplified grooming activities. So there's a kind of self-injury that some dogs engage in called acrylic dermatitis. But essentially, it's a dog who's licking at its paw and then keeps licking at it and licks and licks and licks until the skin breaks, and they keep licking. They continue to do it until it's bleeding. And if you think about self-injury that way, that animal is probably licking as an attempt to soothe, and his stress may be such that that impulse to self-soothe gets dialed all the way up. If we think about human self-injury in those terms, then it can be seen as an attempt to soothe and probably an effort to have the body release some of the, you know, the internal opiates that are released in response to grooming.
One of the stories I thought were really interesting within the book dealt with this, and that was when there was surgery done on a gorilla, I believe it was, that in order to keep it from picking at its wound, they intentionally ungroomed it, you know, with chewing gum on his fur and painting his toenails so that he would pick at those things instead of at the wound. Catherine Bowers, what happened there?
Yeah, this was a gorilla named Babek who'd had a heart procedure done, and the doctors who worked on him wanted to make sure that he didn't pick and poke and reopen his surgical wound when he woke up. Barbara says in the book that she can tell her human patients, don't touch your wound, but you can't exactly tell that to a gorilla. So veterinarians have had to become very creative about how they keep animals from accidentally injuring themselves in their quest to groom themselves. So what they did was they surgically sewed Babek's chest wound back up, but then they painted his toenails bright red, and they put some chewed up chewing gum and then sterilized it in the microwave, let it cool, and worked it into his fur. And they sewed a few extra false stitches along other areas of his body so that when he woke up, instead of his fingers moving toward that chest wound, they had all of these other distractions that he could start picking at instead.
And did it work?
Yes. It did, and this was not unique to Babek either. This is a technique that veterinarians tell us they use a lot, especially with primates.
You know, there may be really an insight for human self-injuring patients that comes from that story, because one of the things we learned from veterinarians is that animals hurt themselves. They turn their own, you know, hands or beaks or whatever against themselves when they're bored. And boredom is a primary trigger. So one thought about a self-injuring patient, in the case of Bobek, they basically created all these distractions to keep his hands very busy, his fingers busy, you know, pulling the gum out and undoing the stitches. And it may be a little bit of metaphor, or maybe it's a practical idea that self-injuring human patients may be thought of in some sense as bored, not having enough stimulation, not having enough environmental enrichment, which is how the veterinarians would talk about it. And that's what a veterinarian would do for a self-injuring patient. He or she would enrich the environment, make it more interesting.
And obesity, eating disorders, we've seen this in the animal kingdom as well. How have we seen that?
Mrs. Catherine, Barbara and I, when we started this project, we had a kind of a concept that animals in the wild were probably lean and healthy and ate what you might call a perfect diet, a perfect organic diet. They stopped when they were sated, and they kind of had a nutritional wisdom about what they ate. But what we realized was that, and this was after talking to veterinarians and people who've observed a lot of animals in the wild, is that most animals, given the opportunity, will overconsume. But the difference is that most animals don't have constant access to lots and lots of food the way that we do. What we learned is that animals can become obese naturally the way human populations can become obese with just lots of extra food around. There's lots of other factors in obesity and the human obesity epidemic, and we look at a few of those too.
It's just also interesting to learn about the fascinating parallel on the animal side. Obesity in cats and dogs has become such an issue that there are diet pills that are marketed for dogs now. There is Pfizer has actually a drug that's for a diet pill for dogs. There is liposuction that's been done on some dogs, and there's even a diet that some prescribe for the obese feline, which is a low carbohydrate, high protein diet, which they call the Catkins diet. So, yeah, I mean, it's really a parallel problem.
In essence, what we're seeing is that it's really almost natural to overconsume.
Yeah, that was one of the sort of counterintuitive takeaways, that in fact, having an internal satiety mechanism doesn't really make sense from an evolutionary perspective if your environment is almost certainly to have periods of scarcity. So if you're living in an environment where scarcity is likely, then when there's abundance, you should be hardwired to overconsume, to sort of store up. And that's seen in companion animals as well, and we share a common ancestor with, for example, dogs about 60 million years ago. So it seems as though these, you know, neurobiological impulses to overconsume are very ancient and conserved across, you know, a lot of mammalian species.
What about underconsumption?
Yeah, this was something we also asked ourselves, was if animals can become obese, can animals also get eating disorders, something that might look like human anorexia nervosa? And this was a place where Barbara and I were really skeptical, and we just thought there's no possible way, because if you think about anorexia nervosa as, let's say, a teen girl looking in the mirror saying, I look fat, and then deciding to go on a calorie-restricting diet for that, then, of course, no animal is going to do that. But if you think of animal eating as tied in with social stress and predatory stress, then you start seeing that anxiety and stress can affect eating, and that's something that veterinarians will say also.
We actually learned about a syndrome that agricultural veterinarians have described. Some female pigs will deal with the transition from being dependent on the mother to being part of a more, you know, adolescent or adult hierarchy, herd hierarchy. Some of these females will respond to the stress by decreasing how much they eat, and some of them actually will stop eating altogether and actually starve themselves to death. So the question is, well, what are the linkages between that behavior in a pig and human anorexia nervosa?
And we also, this is Catherine, learned about dolphins and some primates who will force themselves to throw up after they eat. And it's often tied into social stress within their group, and it looks something like bulimia nervosa. And again, these are not identical syndromes because we're talking about different kinds of animals, but we think that these underlying deeper behaviors are really useful for psychiatrists to keep in mind as they're looking at their human patients.
Barbara, you brought up the linkages. Let's talk for a moment about linkages. Is there something that, say, psychiatrists can take away from the animal behavior to help treat humans who are dealing with either bulimia or anorexia? What is that linkage?
Mm-hmm. To go back to the destigmatizing piece, as a point of departure, I think it can be helpful to know that it's not uniquely human or disordered, that in fact non-human animals have the same kinds of problems, same food-related problems. For some patients, that can be helpful. But moving beyond that to mechanism, it's interesting to learn about this syndrome Catherine was talking about, regurgitation and reingestion in these marine mammals and great apes. And although veterinarians are quick to point out that this is not identical to bulimia nervosa in human beings, the self-induced vomiting seems to be an effort on the part of the animal to soothe themselves in the context of social stress. There's an interesting parallel in that some human patients with bulimia nervosa describe a soothing coming not only from the binge arc of the bulimia nervosa, but also from the purge. And then the question is, well, is there some neurobiological phenomenon in which vomiting leads to the release of some opiates or some, you know, endogenous chemicals that is providing a kind of soothing effect? And there's also a really interesting phenomenon among some animals, birds, for example, who will use vomiting as a defensive mechanism, literally an anti-predator kind of defense. The phenomenon is called defensive regurgitation. It's seen in vultures and other animals. And without being too metaphorical, it is interesting, I think, to a psychiatrist just to hear the term defensive regurgitation and begin to make connections.
Let's move into then some of the more what seems to be physical, like syncope, like heart disease, like cancer. When we reach back into the animal kingdom and even the ancient animal kingdom, which you talked about, like even as far back as dinosaurs, what do we draw from them to understand these disorders?
It's interesting just to kind of begin to turn the lights on a little bit and think about these really common, quote-unquote, human medical problems as, first of all, not uniquely human. So, yes, we're talking about syncope, which is fainting, or breast cancer and brain tumors, or heart attacks and all these kinds of problems. They're not uniquely human. But not only are they not uniquely human, they are not unique to our modern times. And this is one of these sort of what we call obvious/non-obvious kinds of realizations. Because, of course, any mammal, any animal with breasts, by definition, would be a mammal, could potentially get breast cancer. And it's actually been seen in mammals as varied as, you know, cats and dogs, camels and kangaroos, even beluga whales have been found to have breast cancer. And in fact, it undoubtedly occurred among ancient animals as well. During biblical times, there are references to human beings having a breast cancer, but much, much, much before that in non-human mammals. We saw an article that it was entitled The Epidemiology of Dinosaur Cancer that really went into kind of a list of all of the different tumors, some benign, some malignant, some primary, some metastatic, that had been found in the bones of all kinds of species of dinosaurs. And that just expanded the whole way that we started thinking about other kinds of diseases, by the way, including psychiatric illness, which I think we very often think of as not only uniquely human, but unique to our modern times.
One of the things that was interesting about breast cancer was that certain animals within the species get it less frequently, like milk cows.
Yeah.
Veterinarians call those the professional lactators, and they have noticed that they get breast cancer at much, much lower rates than other mammals do.
And so that's kind of telling as well.
Well, definitely it tracks with the human epidemiology that has shown that breastfeeding among, you know, human females is definitely provides some protection against breast cancer, you know, breastfeeding for a longer period of time. Yeah, it tracks and it's worth looking at.
And it makes you wonder about other kinds of cancers and what is the activity that protects the body in some way against that cancer, or can you make those connections?
Well, that's a really interesting question. We learned about a fascinating theory called Peto's paradox. There was a scientist, a British scientist, who noticed something very interesting. He made the point that if cancer is caused by mutation and cell division, then animals, species of animals that were very, very big, elephants and whales, for example, who would need to have many more cell divisions to attain their ultimate size, that they should be riddled with cancer. and that very tiny animals, like mice and whatever, birds, should have no cancer. And in fact, that was not the case. It turns out that very large animals, it seems, and it's a little hard to be sure about this, have a remarkably low incidence of cancer. And so that has sort of led evolutionary biologists and now some medical scientists to begin looking at what is it about the genome of very large species that could potentially be protecting them from cancer. And that's an exciting area to think about.
In terms of the medical community, the psychology community, the veterinarian community, what should we be thinking about as our next step?
We think the next step really is just to develop bridges of communication between the human and the animal side. It's unfortunate, but physicians and veterinarians have not really worked together in the past too much. Our schools are too often in different places, and we, the physicians, don't really read their literature or go to their conferences. So Catherine and I have actually developed Zubiquity conferences. We started here in Los Angeles, and the purpose is to bring together academic veterinarians and physicians to discuss the same diseases that they treat in different species. The first two that we had involved faculty from the UCLA School of Medicine and then faculty from the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. And we have had cases of breast cancer presented. So we'll have, for example, you know, breast cancer in a 8-year-old Siamese cat and breast cancer in a 42-year-old psychotherapist. And we will have the cases presented, and then a physician comments on the animal case and the veterinarian comments on the human case, and then an auditorium composed of about 50% DVMs and 50% MDs will engage in this comparative conversation. And topics that we've covered in this way have included self-injury, anxiety disorders in dogs and in cats and in humans, bullying, brain tumors. And actually, what we then do in the afternoon is we take the entire group, we put everybody on a bus, and we go to our local zoo, the Los Angeles Zoo in this case, where the experts there, the veterinarians, lead the group on walk rounds. And so we have more discussion of, you know, animal, human, medical, and psychiatric parallels. So we really feel that the first step is for physicians, nurses, psychotherapists, anyone who's dealing with providing care to human patients, begin thinking about the same problems on the animal side and talking to vets, going into their literature, and attending these kinds of conferences.
Thank you so much, Catherine Bowers and Barbara Natterson Horowitz. Really a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara Natterson Horowitz is a cardiology professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and serves on the medical advisory board of the Los Angeles Zoo. Catherine Bowers was a staff editor at The Atlantic and a writer and producer at CNN International. Together, they co-authored the book Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. When we come back, and as violent conflict and human rights abuses continue throughout so many parts of the world, we'll explore the politics and ethics of humanitarian intervention. Stay tuned. are listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. As the uprisings have turned deadly in the Middle East and as violent conflict and human rights abuses are continuing through so many parts of the world, questions emerge about the responsibilities of the international community to intervene on behalf of human rights victims. Do states have sovereign rights over their citizens, or should outside forces bear responsibility to protect innocent victims within states? If the answer is intervention, what is the appropriate means? How much force can and should be used? In Rwanda, for example, Western nations failed to protect 800,000 Tutsis from the horrific genocide that was perpetrated on them. But in other conflicts, such as Kosovo, NATO intervened, but without authorization. Now, as we watch things develop in the Middle East, the question is, what should the international community do? What should the United Nations do? What are the laws? What are the ethics that should guide these decisions? We have a panel of esteemed experts with us. Frank Chalk is professor of history and director of the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies at Concordia University. He is author of The History and Sociology of Genocide. He was also associate editor of a 3-volume Encyclopedia of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity and co-author of Mobilizing the Will to Intervene, Leadership to Prevent Mass Atrocities. And he's developed The Will to Intervene Project. Jeff Holzgreef is an adjunct professor at Emory University's School of Law. He is author of The Humanitarian Intervention Debate and co-editor of Humanitarian Intervention, Legal, Ethical, and Political Dilemmas. And we have with us Professor Fernando Tesson. He is the Tobias Simon Eminent Scholar at Florida State University College of Law. He's got numerous publications, including Humanitarian Intervention, An Inquiry into Law and Morality, and A Philosophy of International Law. So welcome to all of you. Very pleased to have you with us. I would like to start by saying I realize that no two political situations are really alike, but we've had throughout history so many humanitarian crises. Rwanda, now we're looking at Sudan, some of the things that are going on in the Middle East. Perhaps we should start with Jeffrey Holzgreef and start with your basic question about the moral obligation of the international community for intervention when such horrors are taking place. When should it? When shouldn't it? Walk us through the arguments.
Generally, the rule is in international law and in ethics as well that non-intervention is the prevailing norm, that you don't want states intervening in each other's affairs. But in cases of genocide, gross human rights violations, crimes against humanity, it seems to me that the burden of proof shifts dramatically from not having to explain why you should intervene in order to stop these things from occurring, but rather why you shouldn't intervene. In other words, that the burden of proof shifts from the intervening state to the state that is committing these atrocities, and it's up to them to justify and come up with a reason why the international community shouldn't intervene, for the simple reason that they've, by murdering their own citizens, they've lost all legitimacy, both internally and internationally.
Frank Chalk, you're a strong interventionist. Do you agree?
Under the right circumstances. I think that Jeffrey has already put the basic and most fundamental point very well. The notion that a state is primarily responsible for protecting its own citizens is well established, and the United Nations Charter refers to the sovereignty of states and preventing aggression against states. Indeed, that was one of the major reasons the UN was created. But we've learned from history that there are times when states either try to murder their own citizens en masse or are incapable of stopping warlords within their territory, etc., and these warlords then commit mass atrocities. So we're talking about genocide, crimes against humanity primarily, also sometimes ethnic cleansing and serious war crimes. And we've reached a point in the evolution of the United Nations when it actually becomes feasible to operationalize the basic principle that you forfeit your sovereignty when you refuse to protect your citizens, you refuse offers of assistance by the United Nations or regional organizations to protect your own citizens, and when you persist in murdering large numbers of your own citizens who are civilians and are not doing anything seriously endangering you. And I think the bottom line then is that the UN and regional bodies and neighboring countries will act when the perpetrator of these atrocity crimes is weak enough, does not possess nuclear weapons, and you know, it will be selective. We can't act all the time. One of the basic principles here is, above all, do less harm or do no harm if possible. But the UN will act in order to stop it if it can do so without starting a nuclear conflagration or bringing down half of a continent.
Fernando Tesson, let's bring you in. You've argued that some cases call for humanitarian intervention and that state sovereignty is not inherently valuable. Talk about this.
I basically concur the positions that Jeff and Frank are articulating with the mainstream position nowadays about intervention. I would add some nuances here, though. The question is not so simple. I totally agree with them about those cases that they mentioned, genocide, mass murder, and so forth. But I think I have a slight disagreement with the mainstream position, because I think the mainstream position accords too much respect to basically what I would call criminal regimes. I don't like euphemisms, right? And this idea that the governments are the main, have the main responsibility to protect their own citizens is very good, generally speaking, if we're talking about reasonable regimes. But many regimes are not reasonable, are basically criminal enterprises. They are not, in my view, and should not be entitled to any respect at all. So take a case just to jump, go from abstract principles to actual events. Take intervention in Libya. I mean, I don't regard Colonel Gaddafi as a legitimate government. So when the citizens of Libya rise against Gaddafi and they have a hard time because Gaddafi has the weapons and the strength, I think it should be permissible for outsiders to help these revolutionaries. Traditional international law would not allow that. That's not genocide. That's not mass murder. But I think it is at least morally justified. If it's not legally justified, it's because international law lacks behind morality, in my view, on this issue. Having said that, I also think there are many reasons not to intervene, and government should be very circumspect about this, given the collateral harm, the destruction, and all the things we know occur. But if the requirement of proportionality can be met, then I don't see what good arguments one can have for denying help to in cases like the one in Libya that I just described.
Jeffrey Holzgreef, would you like to join in?
Going back to your introductory comments, I think the answer to the question is what is the appropriate level of force and what means should be used, and is there a single answer or a yardstick against to measure the appropriateness of humanitarian interventions? I think the answer is clearly no, or at least it's limited by the principle that if you do intervene, that you have to produce more good than harm. And clearly some states are not good candidates for humanitarian intervention, no matter how egregious the government of the day may be, simply because intervening is likely to create more conflict and collateral damage and so on and so forth. I think Yemen is a perfect example of that. I can't see any liberal democratic state or even a regional state intervening there without exacerbating the human rights violations that are going on. Again, it almost have to answer these questions on a case-by-case basis. Some interventions are relatively easy to undertake, that the population which is being targeted by the criminal government, as Professor Tesson says, would welcome the intervention and so on and so forth. But sadly, the track record is at best spotty. The most that you can hope for, I think, is to stop egregious human rights violations of the order of genocide and crimes against humanity. The project of nation building, which I think that Fernando Tesson was saying should fall within the orbit of humanitarian intervention in certain circumstances, is much more problematic.
Let's talk about the circumstances in which it's either not quite appropriate, as it sounds like you are saying, Professor Holzgreef. Do certain regimes hide behind such circumstances and make sure it's not massive human rights abuses and make it so complicated that there can't be an intervention? Is that something we should be aware of? Fernando Tesson, perhaps this is in your bailiwick.
Just briefly, I think that it's very interesting what Jeff said, and I agree with. One has to look case by case to see if more good than harm will be caused by military action, given how inherently destructive military action is. But the important thing about that point is that this is not a sovereignty argument. What I'm trying to say here is that I don't give a lot of value to this default principle of sovereignty that supposedly has to be respected in these kinds of cases. So I think that all factors should be taken into account. If, of course, the intervention, as Jeff says, in Syria or Yemen would exacerbate the problem, not solve anything, then nobody should intervene. He's absolutely right about that.
Frank Chalk.
I think we're all being pragmatic, which I think is a great idea. We have to recognize that the principle of the responsibility to protect and intervention and the right to intervene when states are committing atrocities against their own people is a very frightening proposition to most of the world's governments, because many of them are engaged in low-level atrocities. And also, they are worried that in the future, the gun may be turned against them, so to speak. So I think it's very important politically. And I think we do have to think politically as well as in terms of the principles of law, which we should also adhere to. And we have to recognize that we have to demonstrate that there is a system of limits and a system of checks and balances to prevent powerful states from abusing the sovereignty of other countries. And for the first time in history, the UN Security Council incorporated the phrase, the responsibility to protect, in two resolutions, one dealing with Libya and the other dealing with Ivory Coast. So we're making some progress there. But I think we have to recognize limits and what used to be called the Westphalian system of states who were supposed to be respecting the national sovereignty of other states. That was a myth, but it was a useful myth. And we're at the point now where we've breached the Westphalian system, but most states and most governments would like to see it operational for many centuries to come. And so what we're asking them to do is to respect exceptions to the Westphalian system and exceptions to the right of national sovereignty under these extreme conditions. I think maybe we could even agree that as much as we would like and ought to perhaps think about intervening in low-level cases where you have criminal regimes, but the intervention would probably either not work or would be more costly in terms of lives than not intervening, that realpolitik principles may very well prevail. However, there are enough other cases, and if we want to look at historical cases very briefly, I'm thinking about Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge years, when it would have been very difficult to intervene, but it might have been feasible. And I'm thinking about the fact that if we look at Cambodia and the outcome of those years and years of negotiations after the Vietnamese threw the Khmer Rouge out of most of Cambodia, we really don't have a clue as to what we or how to operationalize our principles after we stop a genocidal criminal regime. We saw in Cambodia the UN Transition Authority for Cambodia in 1993. Succeeded in holding really good democratic elections, and then the results were corrupted by a ruthless leader who is still in power in Cambodia. And in many other countries, I mean, even today, if we look back at Rwanda, I worked very closely with General Romeo Dallaire, who was the UN commander in Rwanda, and whose efforts to stop the genocide were frustrated by the great powers in 1994. And nobody really knows what should have come after he received reinforcements, had he done so, or had the UN given him the reinforcements to stop the genocide. I mean, the idea of a kind of Cyprus-type solution, which I think he proposed in one of his cables to New York, where you'd essentially have a line of demarcation with the one force on one side of the line and the other force on the other side of the line, could hardly really have been feasible after the murder of hundreds of thousands of people by, say, 3 or 4 weeks into the genocide. So we have to figure out a lot. And in a way, Afghanistan and Iraq, which are not responsibility to protect cases, but nevertheless show us how difficult it is to sustain any kind of society rebuilding and reconstruction if we don't have really strong local partners who, to follow up on Jeff's point, who believe in some kind of democracy and civic participation. If we don't have partners like that, then we're always going to be seen as neo-imperialist outside invaders and terrible foreigners, etc. So we still have a lot to figure out. I mean, there's a consensus, I think, broadly speaking, among the three of us. But I think our real problems now are to figure out much better ways of protecting people by helping local allies, if there are any, to build a better society after we stop the killing.
What I'd like to move to a bit is about process. And the United Nations itself, since it was formed in the spirit of this kind of human rights idea, but the structure of its decision-making and the rule of law with it and how the decision is supposed to work, the strengths and weaknesses of that, and the politics behind the United Nations decision-making in the international community. Start again with Jeff Holzgreif. Would you like to start with that?
Well, the current international security architecture was a product of the Second World War, and states that founded the United Nations, not unreasonably, having just experienced two world wars in the space of 30 years and untold millions of people killed, basically thought that the war was the worst thing that could happen, and anything that could reduce or eliminate the transboundary use of force was a good thing. And so that they set up very robust principles of non-intervention in the UN Charter in order to accomplish that goal. And in part because of the UN Charter and balance of power considerations and so on and so forth, there hasn't been a third world war since, but there have been a lot of regional conflicts, and there have been a lot of civil wars and internal conflicts, and also a large number of millions of people have been killed, not in foreign wars and not in civil wars, but at the hands of their own governments. In fact, from various empirical studies, have shown over the course of the 20th century that something of the order of five times as many people have died at the hands of their own governments than they have died in foreign and civil wars. So on the one hand, you have this perfectly legitimate desire to limit foreign intervention, but at the other hand, that has given states under the guise of sovereignty to treat their citizens pretty much with a free hand, and that has often been a murderous and bloody free hand. And so the question is, you know, well, maybe we've gone too far in the direction of limiting the use of transboundary force in international relations, and maybe the balance should be that exceptions should be carved out for cases of genocide, gross human rights abuses, and so on and so forth. There are five permanent members of the Security Council, each of whom have a veto over the use of force in the international system. Unfortunately, Russia and China are two of those, and they almost invariably defend the idea of sovereignty, the idea that states should be free to treat their citizens however they want. And this has greatly restricted the ability of the rest of the international community to intervene in cases of genocide and gross human rights abuses. Now, you can talk about reforming the Security Council or moving to some different sort of security architecture, but it's very cold comfort to people who are currently being strapped on torture chambers or, you know, facing ethnic cleansing or whatever, and say, well, you know, we can't do anything. We're very sorry. We're waiting to reform the Security Council. The pressing issue is, you know, what states should do. Should they violate current international law, which is it's illegal to intervene absent a Security Council resolution, or should they turn a blind eye to current international law, which is basically the current practice? States that do intervene pretend to be adhering to international law when they're plainly not, and critics turn a blind eye to their violations. Now, that's an unsatisfactory state of affairs, but I suggest to your audience that a preferable state of affairs to adhering to the letter of the law and not intervening in these cases. So there are two questions I'd pose to the other panelists. One is, what do we do in the current situation? Do we just pretend that international law is adequate to the task? And what do we do in the long term? What should we be working towards? Reform of the Security Council or something entirely different?
Well, let's talk for a moment about the politicization of this whole process. Amnesty International had brought up in their report in 2010 that some of these decisions were actually very politicized, with powerful states shielding their friend states. Fernando Tesson?
I would like to address the process issue generally with reference to the new issue, the politicization question that you just raised. First of all, the United Nations, unfortunately, as a body, general body, whole body, General Assembly, for example, in my opinion, has moved away from friendly attitude toward human rights in the last 20 years or so. At the moment, the Human Rights Council is a sham, anti-Western, anti-traditional civil and political rights. The Security Council is a little bit better because it's dominated by the West. That is criticized in United Nations circles, and I happen to believe that's one of the good things about the Security Council, because there's some hope that the Security Council is going to be more friendly toward traditional liberal values, if you will. My own idea about process, for the reasons that Jeff said, I think the Security Council is very imperfect for the reasons he just said, the veto by these powers and so forth. The ideal solution would be something like an alliance of liberal democracies, meaning by that simply regimes that protect basic human rights themselves and are themselves democratic, as the ideal body to authorize these interventions. The question of politicization, Maria, that you raised, I think it is absolutely true. Everyone is guilty of that. Russia, China, the United States, occasionally in the past, the United Kingdom and France have done so. And that is a big problem, because it creates an asymmetry and inequality that only certain states can ultimately be intervened in, and those are the states that are pariahs. Maybe they deserve to be pariahs, but there are other states that are very bad regimes and are nonetheless protected by the big powers. France, for example, must have recently proposed the authorization of the Second Iraq War was a commercial interest of all kinds and relation with Iraq. The United States has protected, overprotected some allies like Saudi Arabia and others, and so on and so forth. So I think, yeah, that is a serious problem.
Frank Chalk.
I think that it's unrealistic to expect any of the great powers and most of the members of the General Assembly to act for humanitarian, ethical, and moral reasons. I think it is reasonable to expect them to act in what they perceive to be their narrow national interests. And I think there's a way to shift the debate to what their real national interest is in preventing mass atrocities and then helping to reconstruct societies with local partners. I think we need to point out that there are, very briefly, five major reasons why it's in the national interest of most countries to prevent mass atrocities in other countries. One, to recognize that mass atrocities engender widespread and very practical threats from terrorism, piracy, and other forms of lawlessness on land and sea. Second, that mass atrocities facilitate the growth and spread of warlordism, which blocks our access to vital raw materials and at economically viable prices, and all the obvious reasons that we see in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, where coltan is increasingly under the control of criminal warlords. Third, the mass atrocities trigger avalanches of refugees and internally displaced populations, which together with global warming then accelerate the incidence and spread of lethal infectious diseases all over the world. It's not just travel, business travel, and tourism and trade, which make us a global village. It's also the fact that as we travel, we carry with us whatever viruses and bacteria the people on the airplane shared with us. Fourth, mass atrocities are spawning single interest parties that align themselves on xenophobic programs and are creating a backlash against refugees and immigrants from the Southern Hemisphere. And so if we prevent the mass atrocities, we don't get the backlash. And finally, the mass atrocities foster the spread of national and transnational criminal networks, which we then pay the price for in our own countries. So there are good practical political reasons, but we have failed in the human rights community to make these points, to educate our own publics and our own leaders. If we keep harping on the ethical and moral reasons, which I agree with fully, the politicians are not going to listen, and the members of the General Assembly and the Security Council are not going to listen. I think the U.S. is ahead of everybody else in recognizing what I just said. And there has been progress in the White House, in the State Department, in the Defense Department in Washington, in AIB, et cetera, in this area. And much more attention needs to be devoted to what is happening under the Obama administration in respect to preventing mass atrocities. And the Harvard Mass Atrocity Response Operations Handbook, and the handbook supposedly coming out very soon on aid and reconstruction. So, you know, I think we can actually mobilize support to prevent mass atrocities if we get real And if we focus on national interest, which really means the self-interest of the political leaders of these countries.
I had a comment, a stroke question for Frank Chalk, just following up on what he just said. The problem is almost a political catch-22, that in order to have a humanitarian intervention, you have to mobilize domestic political support for it, partly in security terms, partly in national self-interest terms. And to do that, you have to almost demonize the enemy in order to rally congressional support or popular support.
Yeah, that's how the U.S. got the Marshall Plan.
If you demonize the enemy, then you end up almost committing yourself to having to replace that regime with something that looks like a liberal democracy rather than just ending gross human rights abuses. And that can be very difficult to do and dispiriting for the international community when it doesn't occur that you get rid of one dictator only to find that he's been replaced by someone else. A lot of people, I think, mistakenly view that as a failure of humanitarian intervention. I see any case where gross human rights abuses are ended, even though a liberal democracy is not put in its place, as a success. But unfortunately, that's not the way a lot of the political discourse is framed.
Well, on that note, I would like to say thank you to the three of you.
Thank you very much for having me,
Maria. And thanks to our colleagues.
Thanks.
Frank Chalk is professor of history and director of the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies at Concordia University. He is author of The History and Sociology of Genocide. He was also associate editor of a three-volume encyclopedia of genocide and crimes against humanity and co-author of Mobilizing the Will to Intervene, Leadership to Prevent Mass Atrocities. And he's developed the Will to Intervene Project. Jeff Holzgreef is an adjunct professor at Emory University's School of Law. He is author of The Humanitarian Intervention Debate and co-editor of Humanitarian Intervention, Legal, Ethical, and Political Dilemmas. Professor Fernando Tesson is the Tobias Simon Eminent Scholar at Florida State University College of Law. He's got numerous publications, including Humanitarian Intervention, An Inquiry into Law and Morality, and A Philosophy of International Law. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.